My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
You know, my father used to say, it's good you were abused as a child because it made you a better rock star.
Billy Corgan's rise to fame is one of the most fascinating in rock history.
The Smashing Pumpkins!
Billy Corgan, Smashing Pumpkins.
Homie Simpson, smiling politely.
At one point, he was the front man of one of the biggest rock bands on the planet.
We're probably one of the most misunderstood bands in the history of rock and roll.
But then he sabotaged his own career, burned through every bandmate he ever had.
Everybody was the enemy.
And lost it all, over and over and over again.
Like, what's that about?
It's fun.
This is the story of Billy Corgan. Born William Patrick Corgan in March 1967 on Chicago's North Side, everything about Billy's life was a freak show from the start. His dad, William Corgan Sr., was a blues rock guitarist by trade, and by Billy's account, also a drug-dealing, gun-toting madman.
My father was a drug-dealing, gun-toting musician.
Was he really?
Madman, yeah. Yeah.
Drug dealing?
Oh, yeah.
What kind of drugs?
You name it.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it's quick stories. Like, when I was a kid, my father was a musician, so I remember I wasn't allowed to touch his guitars, but I was allowed to look at them. So I remember one day I was walking past the bedroom, and I saw a guitar case under the bed, and I was like, oh, I wonder what that is. Did he get a new guitar? So I went and slipped the thing out, and I flipped it open. It was a sawed-off shotgun in a guitar case.
Whoa.
Just laying there, you know, in the house. Or, you know, I'd go to open something, it would be like 10 pounds of weed, you know. That was the world I grew up in.
My father was really talented. I mean, he just blew every chance he had. I think he was one of those guys that was very insecure. And so every time he did have an opportunity, he'd blow it with drugs or whatever. He would just blow it. He's just one of those people. But he was very talented.
My dad got arrested a bunch of times, and massive busts and drug. It's just crazy. And gun and people knocking on the door in the middle of the night and getting shot at. And my dad says he's been shot at 9 times.
His parents split when Billy was just about 4 years old, and his mother was institutionalized.
My mother was institutionalized when I was 4 years old, and I never lived with her again. She went away for years, and when she came out, she was so different because of probably electric shock or whatever they put her through. She was like a different person.
His early years shuttled between relatives until landing with his dad and a new stepmother in the suburbs. And that's where things went from unstable to outright cruel. Billy has alleged that both his father and his stepmom were violent with him, both physically and emotionally.
And I look back very humbly on some teachers and stuff that pulled me aside and said, man, what's going on? I guess I didn't really think that there was a context by which to talk to him in. Like if I told him, oh, you know, I'm getting the shit kicked out of me every day, you know, that they would have done anything. You know what I mean? It isn't like today where people go to jail for abusing their kids, and there's public service messages. I mean, when I grew up, there was no information. There was nothing. It was like there was nowhere to go. So even if somebody pulled you aside, you think, well, I'm just going to get in more trouble.
Well, I think the abuse that I went through as a child sort of encouraged my creativity because I had to figure out a way to survive in order to deal with the outside circumstances. When I developed a keen sense of imagination to sort of take myself away from it. So I suppose that might be the beginning of being an artist.
The household was a pressure cooker of violence and dread.
I cut myself. I stayed up all night. You know, I did things with sleep deprivation. You know, I got into, like, I guess what you would call obsessive compulsive behaviors these days. Like, I had 10,000 baseball cards, and I would take them apart and alphabetize them you know, for 5 hours, mind-numbingly so, and then the next day decide to put them all in numerical order. Probably had about 3 to 4 periods in my life where I've been completely despondent, ready to jump off a roof.
If there was one bright spot, it was Billy's younger half-brother, Jesse. Jesse was born with special needs, mild cerebral palsy, Tourette's syndrome, a serious heart condition, a child whom doctors once pessimistically said had no potential. Billy took on the role of Jesse's protector and de facto caretaker. He defended him from bullies and helped him with pretty much everything from speaking clearly to walking and eating meals. Looking after his little brother gave Billy a fierce sense of purpose and also a wellspring of anger at how cruel the world could be. As you would expect, music became his creative outlet to help him escape from the shit show that was his family life.
When I was, I think, about 7, they came to our school and they tested everybody in the school. They did this sort of strange music test. They right. played different tones and you had to say it was high or low. It was pretty simple to me.
Right.
And anyway, so about a week later, they called me and my family into the office and the principal said, your son just got the highest score ever on this test in the state of Illinois. And it's such a fluke. The score is so high. Can we have your permission to retest him? Because we think maybe he just guessed the right. answers, right? And so my father said, sure. They retested me like right at that moment, and I tested higher.
Billy's family didn't give a fuck about his talents. They were too busy dealing with their own mess to see what was right in front of them. It wasn't until his teenage years that Billy picked up one of his dad's guitars and started playing. No encouragement, no support, just him figuring it out on his own.
I was 14 years old when I first started playing the guitar. I played 4 hours a day, every day.
In the beginning, he was very dismissive.
Of the music?
Yeah, he was not supportive of me playing the guitar. And my father was a great musician. I mean that with great sincerity. My father was truly talented. And in the beginning, he was not supportive at all, didn't want me to play the guitar, didn't want me involved in music.
And I remember going to some of the kids in my school who played, who'd been playing for a few years, got lessons and the whole thing. And, you know, they were kind of arrogant. Yeah, whatever, you're the new kid. And about 6 months later, when I hooked back up to these kids, I was blowing them out of the water.
Against all odds, Billy had the best of both worlds in high school. He rocked out in a bunch of bands, but was also an honor student, excelling academically. So good, in fact, that the University of Michigan offered him a scholarship. But despite the academic success and potential future ahead, Billy didn't give a shit about scholarships. I mean, who the fuck cares about some degree when you already know you're destined to become a fucking global rock star?
Well, I was recruited by the University of Michigan for political science. I was offered a full ride scholarship out of high school. And I would have been the first person in my family to go to college. And I decided instead to go into music, and my family tore their hair out because here I had an academic career waiting for me. I just wanted to be a musician.
Straight out of high school, Billy bolted to Florida with his first real band, dramatically named The Marked, an ode to his birthmark, a perceived flaw in his body that as a child made him feel less than.
Something in my generation that would have been totally disqualifying.
Right.
You know, like, if I had any dreams of being an actor when I was a kid, and when, you know, you're kids, you think all sorts of things, I would definitely think no one would ever hire me as an actor because I have a birthmark. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, at 7 years old, my cosmetic issue was already disqualifying.
Well,
maybe I would have been a great actor, maybe not.
That band, however, went nowhere.
I thought my family would support me as an artist, but artists is not necessarily always something that families believe in. They tend to think first of a person's survival as a material thing, not as a spiritual nourishment. And music is, of course, spiritual nourishment, but it doesn't often pay the bills.
Corgan returned to Chicago with a bruised ego and a determination to start something entirely new. In 1987 and 1988, he did a stint in a local group called Deep Blue Dream, even playing alongside future industrial metal star Wayne Static. But Billy wasn't satisfied backing someone else's vision. Plus, his family wasn't supporting his dream, so he needed to pay bills on his own. And since the band wasn't taking off, he quit and found a job at a record store.
In 1990, I was working at a used record store making $12,000 a year.
While working there, Corgan met guitarist James Ehaw, and with him, Billy began sketching out the Smashing Pumpkins, the band that would soon consume his life. Around the same time, after a chance encounter outside a club, Billy also met bassist Darcy Retzky and convinced her to join his band.
We didn't want to sound like anybody in Chicago. We saw that as the death of our future. We were incredibly isolated from the scenes in New York and L.A., which allowed us to figure out who we were long before we came in contact with the pressure cookers of kind of the mainstream American musical culture.
The trio scraped by with a drum machine until a local club owner told them to get a real drummer for a gig. Enter Jimmy Chamberlain, a jazz-trained wild man who added layers to the Pumpkins' sound with heavy, frantic drumming. On October 5th, 1988, the Smashing Pumpkins played their first show as a four-piece at Chicago's Cabaret Metro. The crowd had no idea what hit them. Here was this tall, pale kid pouring out angst on stage like his life depended on it. And a band behind him that could go from whisper soft to roaring chaos in a heartbeat. It didn't take long for the Pumpkins to make a name in the Chicago scene.
The Chicago music scene was really small, even though we were in a big city. One of the great advantages that the Chicago bands had over, say, bands from New York or LA is you could take chances because you didn't have these hipsters breathing down your neck. It's not to say Chicago didn't have hipsters and they didn't like us very much, but we didn't really care. But, you know, unfortunately, when you go to New York and LA, the hipsters write for the New York Times. You know, it's a different standard that you have to run the gauntlet on. So we were able to take these crazy chances, you know. I don't want to say it's as simple as a time of innocence, but it's felt like a time of freedom, maybe is a better way to say it.
Interestingly, around that time, Corgan was dating Courtney Love. The two met in late 1989, right as the Smashing Pumpkins were starting to crawl out of Chicago's underground. Courtney, still hustling to get Hole off the ground, had already burned through half the West Coast and most of its musicians. She and Billy clicked immediately. Not in a slow burn, soulmates kind of way, but like two firecrackers thrown into a trash can. By 1990, they were dating seriously. Corgan even wrote poems about her, but then came Kurt Cobain. Right as Nirvana was blowing up, Courtney crossed paths with Kurt and decided she liked his vibe more. Grungier, greamier, and crucially, more famous. To hear Corgan tell it, she cheated on him with Kurt.
She showed up looking very sexy, not thinking that she was going to walk 5 minutes down the block and run into Kurt Cobain, and the rest is history.
Which she did.
Well, she'd been with Kurt on some level previously, but it wasn't a sort of a full-blown romance. And then she hooked up with Kurt that night. They were together, and then the next morning she called me asking me if she could come over to my place. By which I said, well, if you slept with, you know, rock star A, you can't come back to rock star B. And she went off to Minneapolis, and then next thing you know, they were getting married, and it was all this, you know, thing.
For years, he'd lob little jabs in interviews. Eventually, however, he made peace with both Courtney and Kurt.
We kind of made this weird peace where it seemed, whatever that was, seemed to go away. And it was a very nice and friendly. It's not saying we sat there and talked about the moon and the stars, but it went from, I'm not sure I like you, and I know you definitely don't like me, to like, how you doing? Is everything cool? Yeah, we're good. Talk about the baby. You know, it was, we reached that point where it was like a professional.
It was cordial.
Yes. And, you know, there were even times where she'd want me to call the house to talk to her about something. And of course, Kurt would pick up the phone and we'd have a couple minute, like, how you doing? You good? Yeah, it's all good, you know. Like, I'm not saying we were BFF. I would never say that because I've seen plenty of other people do that that weren't BFF. And I know the inside story more than most people know. But we got to that point.
He even helped Courtney with her own music.
I had though, but you ended up writing the majority of the songs, true or false?
So then we're sitting there and it's like, well, let's just start writing some songs. It was no problem. Started writing some songs together. I throw in an idea, take this one, throw in an idea, da-da-da-da-da. No big deal. I helped them write some songs.
Oh, I believe it.
Nothing more complicated than that.
But back to the Pumpkins. Their 1991 debut album, Gish, was an underground success. A trippy mix of heavy metal riffs and psychedelic swirl that did better than anyone expected.
I'm struck by how naive we really were. We had no idea of the record business. We had no idea of what was expected of us. And I think that's what really makes the album special.
According to most fans, to this day, Snail, Tristessa, and Windowpane are the best three consecutive songs in the Smashing Pumpkins discography. 15 minutes of pure wonder. It's definitely not the Pumpkins in their final form, and yet it's an amazing first album. If you compare it to most other bands' first albums, it blows them out of this world. Yet, some rock purists still found reasons to complain about it.
When the album came out, we saw this weird backlash because it was, right away, people said, it's too overproduced, it's too good, which blew our mind because how can something be too good? We were criticized for being too good.
It would be like you make an amazing meal and somebody takes you in a room and goes, if you would just make a fucking hot dog, you'd be 10 times bigger and make a lot more money. Why can't you just make a fucking hot dog? And you're like, but I'm a master chef and I make these beautiful cakes. And they're like, no, you're a fucking dummy. You need to make hot dogs.
But Corgan refused to make fucking hot dogs. And with the Pumpkins' 1993 follow-up, Siamese Dream, he started to be acclaimed as an alternative rock oracle.
After Gish came out, we toured approximately 14 months on the album. We were very aware that there was going to be an expectation placed on us, particularly because we knew that our next album would be coming out on a major label.
Recorded under intense pressure, both internal and external, Siamese Dream became a multi-platinum hit and launched the Smashing Pumpkins into rock stratosphere.
I had gone down in the summer before we started the record to hang with Billy, and he was going to play me demos. And so I picked him up in my car, he hopped in, and we were driving around suburbs and neighborhoods of Chicago, and he'd play a song, I'd hear a little bit, and then he'd stop it. And I'd go, let me play something else. And I go, what's that called? And one of the songs was Rocket, I remember that. And he played maybe five or six things, but he'd start playing things and then stop right away. And after about 45 minutes, I was like, you can just let it play, man. I'm not being critical. I just want to hear what you're doing. And he said, I'm not done writing. He said, I just realized playing all these songs for you, I'm not happy with where we are, and I need to write more. And that would have been another 6 months of hang time while I just waited while he kept writing. In that 6 months, he wrote Today, Cherub Rock, and Disarm, because he just felt like he had songs, but he knew that the whole record had to have great songs all the way through, and it had to have a kind of an epic feel to it.
The only way the songs seemed to improve, and the only way I saw any emotion coming out of my band, was when I was able to write a song that was really close to myself. And it was in that period that I started writing songs like Today and Disarm and Cherub Rock, songs that really expressed my frustration, my hopes, my fears, my dreams, blah, blah, blah.
Songs like Today, Cherub Rock, and Disarm were all over MTV and the radio, anthems of beautifully crafted despair that somehow connected with millions of listeners who found catharsis in Corgan's nasal wail and searing guitars.
So I used to live, if anybody knows Chicago, I used to live on the Northwest Side, Austin, Addison area. Somebody picked me up, and as I was waiting to be picked up, I suddenly heard this riff in my head. And this is back in the day before phones. So the guy picked me up, and I said, don't say anything. And I spent the 25 minutes going down Irving Park singing the riff in my head and got to my apartment, which was above the music box, grabbed my guitar, and figured out the riff, and that's the riff.
Behind the scenes, though, things were anything but zen. Corrigan had a reputation for being an obsessive control freak in the studio. The media painted him as rock's egomaniac du jour, and honestly, Billy didn't do much to dispel that image. He was driven, possessed with a singular vision for his music, even if that meant acting like a jerk to get it right. Truth be told, the band as a whole was pretty dysfunctional.
I'm sorry if I don't mean to be insulting at all. I just don't really think that any amount of therapy is ever going to help this band. Jimmy is incredibly paranoid all of the time, and James, it's a different thing with him every week. It's, you know, one week he thought that his dog was possessed, and Billy flew off the handle and just couldn't take it anymore. So he said, you know, well, fine, let's get a witch doctor then. So we went to this witch doctor, and then the next month it was the tarot card reader, you know.
Fame only amped up their eccentricities, and so Corgan struggled with anxiety and depression even as his songs topped the charts. For somebody so successful, he often seemed downright miserable.
I was incredibly unprepared for the pressure that success brought me. The good thing was I was successful. The bad thing was I didn't know how to put success in any context because I hadn't known success in my own personal life. And now I was a publicly successful person, but not a privately successful one.
By 1995, Corgan completed his transformation from scruffy indie rocker to full-fledged rock icon. He shaved his head and often donned his now famous Black Zero shirt, cultivating an image that fans instantly recognized. Billy Corgan had become the unmistakable face of a generation of disaffected youth.
Billy Corgan, Smashing Pumpkins.
Homie Simpson, smiling politely. You know, my kids think you're the greatest.
By the mid-90s, the Smashing Pumpkins were on top of the world.
I mean, you were even referenced as the next Nirvana at one point, right? Weren't you literally labeled something like that?
We were the next a lot of things.
Okay.
There's this review that exists somewhere where it was like, it was Gish, and they compared us, it was like Black Crowes, Led Zeppelin, R.E.M., The Cure. Like, they could not figure out what band we were. So it was
right.
Like eight bands that didn't go together.
Oh, I see. They needed to, like...
They were like a soup, you know
I
what
see.
I mean?
I see. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Their 1995 double album, Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, was an ambitious monster piece that truly lived up to its name. It debuted at number one, sold around 10 million copies in the U.S., and scored 7 Grammy nominations.
I remember walking with a friend who used to work at MTV at Coney Island in like 1993. Right. And we're walking down and I said, I already have the title for the next album. And the friend goes, what's it going to be called? And I said, it's going to be called Melancholy and an Infinite Sadness. And she's like, what does it mean? And I'm like, I don't know, but it sounds cool. You know what I mean?
Melancholy gave the world 1979, Corgan's biggest hit ever, along with bruisers like Bullet with Butterfly Wings and tender songs like Tonight Tonight. And at this point, he was being hailed by many as a true visionary.
You know, my father used to say, it's good you were abused as a child because it made you a better rock star. I mean, that's a really messed up thing to say. And he said it more than once. It wasn't a one-time thing.
Yet, as the band was reaching new heights of glory, tragedy struck. On July 12th, 1996, touring keyboardist Jonathan Melvoin overdosed on heroin in a Manhattan hotel room and died beside drummer Jimmy Chamberlain.
They apparently ingested a quantity of narcotics intravenously. They both passed out as a result of this ingestion.
Smashing Pumpkins, said by their managers to be totally destroyed by Melvoin's death, postponed all tour dates through July 27th on Friday after drummer Jimmy Chamberlain, who has a history of drug problems himself and who police say was with Melvoin when he called 911 late Thursday night, was arrested. Allison Stewart got more at Manhattan's 19th Police Precinct on Friday afternoon.
The two had been binging together. Jimmy barely survived, got arrested for drug possession, and was promptly fired from the band in the aftermath.
And I'm here outside the 19th precinct where Jimmy Chamberlain, drummer for Smashing Pumpkins, was charged with criminal possession of a controlled substance. Apparently, Chamberlain was in the room when John Melvoin OD'd. The story goes like this. He was unable to revive Melvoin, called 911, was told to put him in the shower and stick his head under the water. When that didn't work and paramedics arrived, there was drug paraphernalia in the room. Melvoin was pronounced dead of a heroin overdose, self-administered with a syringe. 10:30 this morning, the entire band came down to the station. All were questioned. About 1 o'clock today, Darcy, James Eha, and Corrigan left. Chamberlain was still inside.
1 minute, the Pumpkins were on top. The next, they were a scandal-ridden trio. Firing their drummer at the height of their fame was a huge blow. Chamberlain's explosive drumming was a key part of their sound. But Corrigan and the others felt they had no choice if they wanted to keep the band from imploding entirely.
The Pumpkins on Monday, who plan to return to the road a week from Monday in Vancouver, will hold auditions in Chicago to replace drummer Jimmy Chamberlain, who was with Melvoin when he died.
Billy was also going through a divorce from his first wife around that time and coping with the death of his mother, who lost her battle with cancer in December 1996. The combined weight of these events crushed him. Corrigan channeled that pain into the Pumpkins' next album, 1998's Adore. If fans expected melancholy round two, they were in for a surprise. Adore was a stark departure, a brooding elegy drenched in electronics and melancholy. The usual pummeling drums were largely absent, unsurprising since Jimmy Chamberlain was gone, and in their place were gloomy synths and drum machines.
We started out, I think, with some drums from Matt Walker, and then we processed them, and then processed them. We tried all acoustic things and electronic things, and the hard thing with the drumming was, you know, using three different drummers and a lot of drum machines. We were really concerned about making the drums be all similar throughout the album, so that you're hard pressed to tell which are real drums and which are not real drums, but you want it to be all kind of in the same vein of everything. So
critics were split. Some appreciated the bold shift, others missed the old Pumpkins. Many fans didn't know what to make of somber electronic tinged ballads about loss and isolation from the guy who had just given them arena-sized rock anthems. The album sold only about 1.3 million copies in the US, a commercial disappointment compared to the Pumpkins' earlier multi-platinum triumphs.
At number one, ladies and gentlemen, I cannot tell you how many people are outside. NSYNC fans, I mean, it's absolutely insane. NSYNC TV is about to get underway. Please welcome in. They're performing the number one video on Total Request Live. Here's NSYNC doing Tearing Up My Heart. Guys?
In the late 90s, alternative rock's popularity was fading across the board, and Adore felt like a requiem for an era. Corrigan later admitted that during this time he was severely depressed and felt more misunderstood and alone than ever before. The rat in a cage he sang about in Bullet with Butterfly Wings seemed less metaphorical and more like his day-to-day reality.
Bullet with Butterfly Wings was my saying, you want me to be this rat in the cage? Here I am. Here's the dumb beat. Here's the big rock chorus. And it was a big hit. And they were like, great, give me more of that. And to this day, by the way, and that's what, 28 years ago? To this day, the fans, God bless them, and the critics are still asking for more of the rat in the cage guy. They ain't asking for this guy. Do you understand? It reconfirms everything that your parents told you, which is if you're not this, you're worthless. You have no value. If you're not willing to sacrifice in these ways, you are worthless. If you're not willing to do what we say, you are worthless.
it's impossible to find the piece that I would be after as long as I'm in the public eye.
Yeah, right.
After the confused reception to a door, Billy entered salvage mode and brought back Jimmy Chamberlain, who now claimed to be clean and sober.
You know, we sat down and decided what we were going to do for the next album. We decided to ask Jimmy to come back to the band and just make one more record.
With his return, most fans saw a chance of getting back some of that Siamese Dream magic, if not the full glory days of melancholy. Instead, the band put out Machina, the Machines of God, a sprawling, deliberately theatrical concept album that leaned into mythology, mysticism, and meta-commentary on the band's fame and disintegration. Corgan envisioned it as part science fiction, part rock opera, part spiritual reckoning. The story of a rock star named Glass and his band, The Machines of God, a thinly veiled stand-in for the Pumpkins themselves. Billy had grand plans for this to be a two-part narrative, a double album in spirit, if not in release, but only half of it ever made it into stores. Musically, it was all over the map. There were nods to glam, industrial, and even classic arena rock. Far more guitar-driven than Adore, but nowhere near as immediate as their 90s hits. Pitchfork accused the album of being too dense for its own good.
Ladies and gentlemen, performing the Backstreet Boys.
By early 2000, the mainstream charts were overrun by the boy band Apocalypse, and NSYNC, Backstreet Boys, and Britney Spears dominated TRL and radio. Meanwhile, Eminem had just dropped the Slim Shady LP and was flipping pop culture on its head. Over in rock, nu metal was having a moment. Limp Bizkit, Korn, Linkin Park, and Papa Roach were climbing the charts, slamming detuned guitars into rap verses and appealing to angry suburban teens. Corgan's fragile poetry and the prog glam sprawl of his band seemed completely out of place. And so, the Smashing Pumpkins had been pushed to the margins. They were too mainstream for the indie crowd, too weird for the mainstream, and too soft for the nu metal scene.
The band is probably one of the most misunderstood. We're probably one of the most misunderstood bands in the history of rock and roll. I mean, that sounds like a wrestling statement, but it's fairly accurate.
Sales reflected this shift. Despite their name, the Smashing Pumpkins sales numbers were now more modest than ever.
No, I don't care. I don't care about idol pop. I don't care about hair rock. I don't really care. I mean, we're fine, and we've made our music, and we've had a great time. And we're very, very appreciative.
Around this time, Darcy Retzky tapped out. The official line was that she left the band to pursue an acting career, but rumors were that she was battling drug issues and increasingly disengaged from the band. Fans were stunned. Darcy had been part of the original DNA of the band, but she was swiftly replaced with Melissa Oftermar, fresh off her run with Hole.
Smashing Pumpkins were by far my life-changing music band because of the sonics. I just loved oceans of sound. I wanted layers and layers of guitars and rolling drums and bass, and like that is what captured my heart, and that's what I always wanted to be able to play, and that's kind of what my...
Corgan praised her energy and musicianship, but the vibe was different and everyone could feel it. It didn't feel like a seamless evolution. It was more like a cover-up with duct tape. Also, the album rollout was marred by a lack of label support. Virgin Records balked at releasing both parts of the planned double album.
Everybody in the music business will tell you your value is exponentially related to your success. So your biggest song is here and your next biggest song is here, and there's like a pyramid. And as you go down, you lose value. Your aging becomes part of that loss of value. How do you maintain value, relevancy? You no longer have the record business that used to exist. You no longer have the structure. I mean, the music business is basically a touring business first now.
Right.
And everything else is in support of the touring business. We're lucky in that we continue to be a very large touring band. So you're told over and over again, almost in a propagandistic way, that your value is related to what's on a piece of paper. And then somehow I woke up in the middle of it and I thought, no, that's actually not my value. And so the minute I started saying, no, I know what my real value is. It's that I'm an independent artist who, like a voice in the wilderness, represents something. And I know it's not for everybody. Trust me, I've been getting that message since I was a little kid, including from my own family. But I know what I represents something that's valuable. I can't quite put my finger on it, but I see the consistency of the, let's call it the communication between myself and somebody who's interested in what I do.
So Billy took matters into his own hands. In September 2000, he dropped the second half of the story, Machina Part 2, The Friends and Enemies of Modern Music, as a free digital release distributed through fan-run websites with his blessing. It was the first major album to be released online for free like that, predating Radiohead's In Rainbows by 7 years. It was a very Corgan move, idealistic, disruptive, and defiant. But no amount of creative defiance could top when Billy Corgan randomly announced on a Chicago radio station that the Smashing Pumpkins would break up at the end of that year. This was more than just a band splitting. It felt like 90s alternative rock was officially giving up and dying. And so, in December 2000, the Smashing Pumpkins played their final show for the time being at the Metro in Chicago, the same club where it all began back in 1988. The performance lasted over 4 fucking hours with a set list that spanned their entire catalog. Corgan was just 33 years old and already standing on the ashes of his legacy. The band that sold millions and helped define a generation was gone, and the 90s were officially over. Now Billy Corgan found himself staring into the void of a new millennium with no band, no plans, and no clear future. Just a pile of trauma, a few USB drives full of unreleased songs, and a lingering rage that would power his next act. If anyone thought Billy Corgan would mellow out after the Pumpkins' breakup, they were sorely mistaken. The early 2000s saw Corgan flailing and experimenting in search of a new spark, all while airing a lot of dirty laundry in public. First up was Zwan, a new band he formed in late 2001 with Jimmy Chamberlain back on drums.
We're going to go see Billy Corgan's new band.
Yeah, Zwan.
Billy Corgan, Smashing Pumpkins.
Zwan. They added guitarist Matt Sweeney, guitarist David Pajo, and bassist Paz Lenchantin, and set about making a sunnier brand of rock than the Pumpkins ever did. For a brief moment, Zwan actually worked. Their only album, Mary Star of the Sea, released in 2003, got good reviews and had an upbeat, almost spiritual vibe.
There's a long-established concept that gets bandied about, which is misery makes for great art, and I actually think this is, if we were asking a Shinto monk, I think they would laugh at this idea.
Yeah.
Because you're basically saying suffering's good for business, and I don't think suffering's good for business. Crazy's good for business, suffering isn't. I think suffering or the gestalt of here I am ripping my heart open, I think that lasts for about 2 or 3 albums. Mm. At some point you have to mature into the deep end.
So what are you exploring now?
God.
But the honeymoon didn't last. Eventually, while on tour for the album, Corgan abruptly canceled the rest of the dates, and by September 2003, Zwan was officially dead, lasting barely 2 years.
You know, growing up, I wasn't really that close to my family, so I think the band became a second family. And I think I put a lot of feelings and vibes on that family that they didn't necessarily want. They just wanted to be in a band. They didn't want to be my cousin.
In classic fashion, Billy didn't quietly move on. Instead, he publicly slagged off his Zwan bandmates afterward, calling them filthy, opportunistic and selfish, and essentially blamed everyone else for ruining his happy band.
Because I had a false concept of loyalty, and I rode that ship all the way to the bottom. When most people, wiser than I, would have jumped off the ship when it was to their benefit.
With Zwan's collapse, Corgan seemed to spiral through a paranoid crisis in real time. Instead of licking his wounds privately, he went online. And credit to him, he was actually one of the first rock stars to open a personal blog and turn it into a confessional tell-all.
Because, by the way, no one cares about me. Nobody was calling me up. You know what I mean? It wasn't like the biggest names in the business were like, bro, where are you? Come back. We miss you. In fact, a lot of my generational brethren and sistren didn't care if I came back because that was one more person off the chessboard that they didn't have to beat or compete with.
Yeah.
In 2004, Billy unleashed a series of brutal but seemingly vulnerable posts. He dissed his old Smashing Pumpkins bandmates, now blaming James for the Pumpkins breakup and calling Darcy a mean-spirited drug addict. In the same rants, he tore into the Zwan crew, essentially painting himself as the victim of a bunch of ungrateful pieces of shit bandmates.
I was miserable. I was totally miserable. So I was operating off of more of an idealism, like who I wanted to be or who I wished I was.
Yeah.
Because who I really was or how I felt I was miserable.
Later that year, out of the blue, he put out a book of poetry titled Blinking with Fists. And it even debuted on the New York Times bestseller list.
It was a top 20 New York Times bestseller list. Was the number one poetry book of 2004. I think that was the year. Never got one invitation to any poetry festival. Never got an invitation to a school to come teach them about how I became a writer. They just completely turned their backs on me and acted like I was some weird interloper.
But he couldn't stay away from making music for long. In 2005, he dropped his first solo album, The Future Embrace, an electronic shoegaze-tinged collection that was as moody as its gray cover art. Without a band to buffer him, the album put Billy's angst front and center. I mean, perhaps too front and center for some. Reviews were lukewarm, and it sold a modest 69,000 copies in the U.S.
Ultimately, the public's going to abandon you. The record company's going to turn on you at some point when you don't sell enough. So it's really an integrity game.
To put his perceived downfall in context, when he launched his solo tour to support the album, he could only book small clubs instead of the huge arenas he once commanded. Truth be told, he was also a bit of a dick, which didn't help sales. During one infamous gig in Australia, fans kept shouting out requests for Smashing Pumpkins songs. Corgan went back and forth, insulting the audience, and ultimately stormed off stage. It was a petulant rock star moment from someone who clearly hadn't made peace with his past.
No, everybody was the enemy. I'll take responsibility, but the business was set up that way.
Yeah.
But after that humbling run, Corgan seemed to reach a wise conclusion. If you can't outrun your legacy, you might as well embrace it. And so in 2006, it was announced on the Smashing Pumpkins official website that the band was getting back together. Well, sort of. In reality, this reunion was basically only Billy and Jimmy Chamberlain. James wasn't invited, and Darcy had been off the grid since 99, with some saying she was running a farm and others speculating she was now homeless after wasting all her Pumpkins money doing drugs. So Corgan brought in a new guitarist, Jeff Schroeder, and a new bassist, Ginger Reyes, later replaced by Nicole Fiorentino, to round out the lineup.
I think the hallmarks of people that I'm attracted to are individuality and honesty. And I think those two in combination, what honesty is, that's a sort of a sliding, slippery slope. But there's sort of an integrity that goes with great people. And as someone who's led a couple bands. I think that's the one thing I've always asked myself and others around me as musicians to do, is to have that sort of integrity and that honesty.
In 2007, the new Smashing Pumpkins released Zeitgeist, their first new album in 7 years. It was loud, politically charged, and brimming with Corgan's trademark snarling vocals and guitar walls. But reviews were mixed, and the album didn't have the cultural impact Corgan perhaps had hoped for. However, it debuted at number 2 on the Billboard charts, and this proved that against all odds, curiosity about the Pumpkins was still sky high. So the band hit the road and toured extensively through 2007 and 2008, and for the first time in decades, Corgan was visibly enjoying himself on stage, and he seemed to happily embrace the sight of big crowds losing their minds to the Pumpkins' hits.
I figured out by the time I was 28 everything I ever needed to know in this crazy world of music and entertainment.
Yeah.
And I lost it and I regained it and I figured it back out. Now I figured it out a different way that has a lot to do with family.
But there's always a but. In March 2009, Chamberlain abruptly left the band again, citing some good old generic creative differences. Corgan found himself the last man standing from the classic four. Rather than call it quits, he obstinately kept the Smashing Pumpkins name alive as essentially a solo project. Throughout 2009 and 2010, he trickled out new Pumpkin songs online. And then he compiled some of them into the 2012 album Oceania, which even earned acclaim as the band's best work since the 90s.
That when it's all said and done, I want the Pumpkins standing on the top of the heap of our generation. And if that means I got to write 800 songs to do it, I'll do it. I ain't shy about that.
With guitarist Jeff Schroeder now as his main collaborator, Billy kept the Pumpkins busy and released more albums, Monuments to an Elegy in 2014 and Shiny and Oh So Bright in 2018. And in between those two albums, Chamberlain rejoined the band. The albums got mixed reviews, but something should be said about how Billy is a master at sabotaging his own success. These albums were not bad by any stretch, but not great either, more like a reflection of his own inner conflict. Imagine that one colleague at the office who's always striving for perfection, the office overachiever, the one who's always on top of things, pushing everyone to match his level, even though he's the most driven and clearly the most capable. Instead of receiving respect and praise, he gets criticized because he's constantly complaining that nobody else is up to his own standards. So he starts patting himself on the back, desperate for validation, unable to see that his perceived arrogance is what's actually preventing others from praising him. But music was only one of Corgan's obsessions in the 2010s. Ever the Renaissance man, he also dove headfirst into professional wrestling. A lifelong wrestling fan, he co-founded a Chicago indie promotion in 2011, then in 2015 joined TNA Wrestling as a creative director and even became its president in 2016. He left after a financial dispute, but by 2017, Corgan went all in and purchased the historic National Wrestling Alliance, NWA, outright. Because why not?
Pro wrestling, what's that about?
It's fun.
See, you do have fun.
Yeah, in quiet, really? In quiet moments. when no one's watching.
And then in 2018, the unthinkable happened. James rejoined the Smashing Pumpkins, and they suddenly had almost the classic lineup again.
You know, James and I hadn't talked for 17, 18 years. Wow. You know, we had no relationship other than sort of through the lawyer thing. So it took time to rebuild just the friendship to where you would even say, do you even want to get in a room and work together?
Noticeably absent was Darcy.
I spent 2 years before all that repairing my relationship, and every time I tried to get in a room with her, so I still haven't been in a room with her for 19 years. it was a telephone thing, and you're trying to sort of say, this can happen, what do you think? Always very pleasant, great, awesome. And only when it became obvious that it wasn't the way she wanted it to be, it turned into this other thing, which was reminiscent of the past. For me, being in a band's like being in a family. And the family rules apply more than the band rules. So from the outside, it looks like, how come Mick doesn't get along with Keith? It's like you don't really understand. You've had such intense experiences together. It's really more like a family thing. So for me, the family rules apply, which is family comes first and all the bullshit comes second.
But while juggling his resurrected band and his wrestling empire, Corgan also settled into a quieter domestic life than one might expect. Since 2013, he's been in a relationship with fashion designer Chloe Mendel, whom he married in 2023, and they have three young children together. Fatherhood seems to have softened him a bit. He's spoken about breaking the cycle of abuse so that his kids won't suffer what he did. For a guy whose own dad claimed abuse made him a better artist, that's a significant change. Through all these chapters, one thing remained constant: Billy Corgan's relentless creative drive. More recently, the Pumpkins released Seer, perceived by most fans to be too monolithic and lacking texture, followed by Adam, a rock opera in three acts, a sprawling 33-song concept album which critics gave a cautiously positive nod to. Point is that nearly 30 years after his peak, instead of cashing out on old formulas, Corgan is still swinging for the fences, ambition undimmed.
I am a radical in an era where there are very few radicals in my business. There's plenty in other places. Mm. But in my world, which is supposed to be full of radicals, there's actually very few.
To this day, he remains a bundle of contradictions, a sensitive soul with a tough-as-nails exterior, a control freak visionary who sometimes torpedoes his own relationships, and a rock icon who refuses to play by anyone's rules.
The Smashing Pumpkins!
As of 2025, Corgan is 58 years old, married with kids, still writing songs, still promoting wrestling shows, and still doing whatever the fuck he wants.